Blog Talk Radio.
When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence.
Dad says Mom doesn't really care about me and that she's lazy.
This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide.
What did I do to make Mommy and Daddy so mad at each other?
Whether or not your child reaches his or her full and healthy potential in life rests in your ability to be mature and put them first.
I love you, Mom and Dad.
Help spread the word to educate and raise awareness. Visit www.paawareness.org to find out more.
Boy, that's really a great PSA. I love to hear that every week. Welcome again to Family Matters, and this is Jill Ajeezy. And thank you all for tuning in tonight. I have some sad news. We've been off the air for a couple of weeks. Michelle was with the ambassador to the Netherlands, the last show that we had, and I was getting an award for lifetime achievement for United Cerebral Palsy Land of Lincoln, which was exciting. And so we've been off for a couple of weeks. It was nice for our great friend Mike Jeffries to host our show for us the last time with Dr. Mike Bone, and they did an outstanding job. But Michelle was going to be on tonight, and she is so incredibly sick with bronchitis, and I just send out great prayers and wishes of wellness to her and hope that she is quickly well, because she is one of the only judges that I know that is doing the right thing for children on the bench in Cook County Family Court. She is doing an outstanding job, just revolutionary in her courtroom and protecting children each and every day that she is on the bench. And of course, her book, The Good Karma Divorce, we can't forget that, is just such a wonderful tool for divorcing families and really for anyone in conflict. So pick that book up. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the great book sites you can get in, and I believe you can even download it as an ebook now. So, Michelle, feel better soon. Of course, all of you know that I am the newly elected president, how exciting for me, of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization and an alienated mom. And so I know of which I speak, and I know how all of you are feeling at the holiday times coming up. And it is, of course, Thanksgiving last week and Christmas approaching and Hanukkah. And it's a difficult time for alienated parents and children that are going through this whole process that we live through each and every day. And I just have to tell you that holidays can be a really mixed blessing. You can make it what you want it to be. Don't sit and be depressed and sad. Be an advocate for yourself and your children and do what you need to do to get through these days. Strong support system. Gather with your friends and family and just try to have a nice time. I am so pleased tonight to have my dear friend and Michelle's dear friend, Mike McCormick. And Mike is with the American Coalition for Fathers and Children. And I thank you, Mike, for being here tonight.
Well, Jill, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
And you are just so involved. We like to say that Mike knows every statistic about everything that has to do with parents and children and fathers and mothers. And this man literally, I mean, we would need really to get all of his information, a 24-hour show, maybe even longer. It could be a telethon.
Well, I hope I can live up to that billing, Jill. There certainly is a lot around the area of family law, and frankly, congratulations to you, actually, on the Lifetime Achievement Awards for Cerebral Palsy. I know that's been very close to you for a long period of time, and as well, best wishes to Judge Lawrence. I know she's been a real advocate for kids and for kids' relationships with their parents for a number of years. So hopefully she'll be better as well soon. But I'll do my best to live up to that high expectation.
Well, I want you to tell us, first of all, because I tease you a lot about the name of the organization where you are, an American Coalition for Fathers and Children, because for the longest time I felt like you were leaving me out. But I want you to tell us a little bit about the mission statement and why you have that name and how all of this came about.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll go back. And, you know, I hear that quite regularly about, well, why aren't you the American Coalition for Families and Children instead of for Fathers and Children? You sound like a father's rights organization. And really, you know, the old saying, nothing could be further from the truth, is apropos. We started in 1996, and I'll say right off the top, about 40% of our membership base are women. What we found in the family courts, though, over the last, you know, 15 years that we've been doing this kind of work and going back for the last several decades, is, Jill, really you are the exception, not the norm, as far as custody goes in terms of being an alienated mother and things of that nature. Right now it's about custody breaks along the lines of about 85% of residency goes to mothers, and about 15% of residency, primary residency, goes to fathers. So really, you know, our organization looked at that and we said, you know, what we really need to do is we need to treat both parties to a divorce equally. And that doesn't necessarily mean the same outcome in every case. But what it does mean is that we need to give children, we call ourselves a shared parenting organization. It's those who are, you know, those who like the system the way it is tend to want to label as father's rights. But we call ourselves a shared parenting organization. Very simply, we believe that children need a mother and a father, regardless of those parents living under the same roof. And as long as you're dealing with fit parents, there's no reason why children shouldn't have a full relationship with both parents. So we want to see all parties affected by a divorce actually treated equally in the courts, and that no child lose a relationship with their parents simply because the parents are no longer going to live with each other.
I love a quote that you actually have on your website, Mike, and I'm just going to read it unless you can remember it verbatim. And it's something that you said in January of 2008. Shared parenting is an issue which knows no bounds. It is neither the domain of conservatives or liberals, poor or wealthy, and pays no attention to ethnicity or sex. Our issues cross all demographics, and our goals are shared and should be supported across all sectors of our society.
Wow, I can't believe I said something like that.
You are brilliant. I told you were brilliant. And that, what I mean, how could you say more?
Well, this is it. I mean, Jill, I've worked extensively with people in all political parties of all political persuasions. I've worked extensively with people of varying economic levels, varying social levels. And the thing about it is that by and large, kids love their parents and parents love their children. And that doesn't have anything to do with your station in life or your political affiliation. And I've never run across families or kids who are experiencing in the throes of their parents' divorces who've ever stopped to ask the question, well, how much money do we have? Because that really affects how much we love our kids. Or what's your political persuasion? Because that should determine whether or not you're able to raise your child. This is just so far beyond those types of considerations. This is a real core issue with respect to our society. And the core issue is this: who is going to raise the children in our society? And what do we want that society to look like when children are not being raised in an intact household? And we have so much data now that tells us that kids do best with both parents fully engaged in their lives, even if the parents are no longer together. And it's really interesting to look at the history of how we arrived at this point, because it really seems to be kind of a mishmash of theories that have brought us here, which actually turn out not to be correct in terms of what's best for the children of divorce and the children of unmarried parentage.
Well, and that's such a great point that you bring up, Mike, is what was the evolution? How did we get to this point? How did we go from the household of my parents, which I had a lovely life, and you know, it was a mom and a dad, an intact family, no one in my family divorced, and now we are just running rampant with divorce at you know, 50%. And so how did we get to this point in our society that all of these broken homes and these children that we think are going to be resilient out of this horrible brokenness, how did we get here?
Well, I kind of, on a very simplistic note, like, we'll say that what we live in today is a disposable society, and that has filtered and flowed into family relationships as well. So, you know, where you talk about your parents' generation, and I come out of that as well. I mean, my mother and father, thankfully and blessedly, are celebrating 50 years of marriage this year.
Me too. Mine just did in September. So,
isn't that fantastic? And a generation ago, that was not unusual, but today that's becoming more and more the exception. And the problem that we see is that there isn't necessarily the sense of long-term commitment that there was a generation ago. And if we want to trace where did this begin, it actually began in the period of the 60s. And for better or for worse, people argue all the time about, you know, no-fault divorce, and should we have no-fault divorce, or should we go back to fault-based divorce? Well, that's an argument for people. I think, you know, it impacts what we're doing right now, but really at the core, that's not the most critical question. But what we do know is that the advent of divorce initiated the generation that we, and the cycle that we see ourselves in today, that has led to the 50% divorce rate. And let me just make this dramatic point from a statistical basis with respect to those who are listening. In 1960 in this country, only 7% of kids grew up in a household that didn't have a mother and a father in it. And that was the result primarily not of divorce, but primarily the result of the death of one of the spouses. That's how kids ended up in single-parent-headed homes. And, you know, when I was a kid, and Joe, I'm sure it was when you were a kid, that kids who came from divorced homes or where there was only one parent present, those kids came from what we call broken homes.
Mm-hmm.
With the advent of no-fault divorce, we've actually seen where now there is no issue involved. Now you can just go in and file for divorce, and whoever files for divorce will be granted a divorce. And so the issue shifted from who was at fault for causing the breakdown of the marriage to fighting over who was going to get custody of the children. And we've seen a tremendous increase up to from 1960, where we had 7% of kids growing up in non-intact households, to today, where 40% of children, 50% of marriages there's a 50% divorce rate, but 40% of children will spend part of their youth between the time they're born and the age of 18 with one of their biological parents living outside of the home. And it resulted from this idea that if you aren't satisfied in your relationship, change your relationship rather than improve the relationship or stay together for the sake of the kids. You rarely see today that people will say, you know what, it may not be the best marriage, but we are going to work it through for the kids. And along with this came numerous shifts in the society in terms of how we approach divorce. It used to be that divorce was looked at as a failure. Now it's just almost looked at as like a life step. It's just, you know, it happens so frequently and it's happened to so many people that it's just, you know, it's just another progression, another path and down the journey of adulthood. And some people unfortunately get divorced and some people don't, but it's so ubiquitous in the society today that people are really only now just beginning to question again what's been the effect of divorce and single parent child rearing on the society. But how we got here, very interesting. And how we got here in the sense of 85% mother custody was just simply tender years doctrines, which gave mothers preference for children of young ages, which moved into which basically was essentially mother preference custody. And then we moved into this thing where we live today, where we said, okay, that's not gender neutral enough. You go back 100 years in our society, and fathers primarily had custody of children. That wasn't thought to be fair. We moved into the tender years doctrine, which is children of a young age living with the mother. Then we moved into a thing called the primary caretaker. And if you look at the period of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and going forward, the primary caretaker was typically the mother. So the children went with the mother. And when we got into the 70s, we started to say, but what about equality? Equality in the workplace for women, equality in the home for men. And out of the feminist movement, came this idea that rather than have a primary caretaker presumption, and part of that being that ties women to the home, let's go to a best interest of the child standard. But what you had was a 30, 40, 50-year foundation of preferences for mother custody. And that carries over, as we're seeing, as we saw, that carried into the best interest of the child doctrines. And I believe that the next move towards this is to actually recognize the parity between men and women that exists in our society today, not only from an employment and work perspective, but from a child caregiving and child rearing perspective. And it's really interesting to see today how more and more people are opting for shared parenting. I think we're in a transition period where the next phase in our society with respect to children who are either born out of wedlock or experience their parents' divorce will be significant shared parenting.
And I think, you know, as we have talked, and we'll address this in just a second, but on a committee that we serve on together in Illinois, that reassessing what the nuclear family is in today's America and in Illinois specifically has been a really difficult job, because we don't have the household that we had with my mother and your father and everybody that, you know, was happy. And now we have gay and lesbian couples. We have parents who've never been married, who have children. And so reassessing that has been quite a task, and addressing all the issues that go along with that. But all of what you have just said just shows all of us that a need for change in divorce culture is so incredibly important.
Absolutely, because what we're doing is we're taking this modern phenomenon, and I like to describe it like this. It used to be that one set of parents had multiple children, but in today's society, you have a set of children that can have multiple parents, whether they be biological parents or step-parents or adoptive parents. It's much more common now, this fluidity of households, and we've become a society of what's known as serial monogamists. The relationships aren't going 40 and 50 and 60 years like they did in our parents' generation. They're typically lasting a much shorter period of time. And out of these briefer unions, 7 to 10 years, children are the product of those unions. And so what we have to do is we have to say, how are we going to address this situation of serial monogamy, where we have so many children being raised in so many different kinds of households? How do we deal with that from the legal perspective, as you're pointing out? And it's requiring a complete reevaluation of how we deal with what we used to call the broken home, how we deal with what is actually becoming very much the norm in the society today.
Well, I think that's one of the things that Michelle points out so often, that you cannot ever label children of divorce, that you have to make them feel as if they're normal and they're part of the whole thing. You know, you can't say from a broken home anymore. It's not politically correct. So we've got to make these kids feel like they fit. You know, I just worry all the time about when you and I, Mike, are in wheelchairs, and we've got all these kids of divorce who and parental alienation who are confused, who have no self-esteem, who can't make decisions, and where are we going to be, you know, as a country,
right,
in 20, 30 years?
And this is the thing, and this is why it is so important to reevaluate the laws, as you know, Jill, because what we've got here is that the research is telling us is that if we want to have children who actually are able to function well in the type of environment that's developed in the society that's that has developed, what we need to do is maintaining the continuity and the stability of the relationships between those children and their biological parents has become much more significant and important than maintaining a single residency that's called home. It's much better for children to know that they have two fully and actively engaged parents than for them to know or to think that they have one primary parent and one satellite or visitor parent. And children are much more adept at having two homes as opposed to having a primary home and a satellite residence. And this, what we know is that when we give children, and this is what the children of divorce are telling us, that rather than seeing one of their parents two out of every 14 days and for a meal on the alternating week, they would much rather have two homes and have more of both parents than have one primary home and less of both parents. And we know
that
this
is the case. I want to tell you, just to interject something quickly, a dear friend of mine who's a news anchor, her name is Marianne Manco, beautiful woman, late 40s, she won't want me to tell her age, but late 40s, and gorgeous, lovely lady, very aggressive, very straightforward, very well-spoken and articulate. And she shared with me some time ago that she was an adult survivor of alienation. And so I had her on my television show the other day and interviewed her, and we talked about it. And she was telling me and really broke down in tears, which I've never seen her do, which I would never do in front of anyone. And she started crying because she said to me that when she was 6 years old, her mother, who was waging an extreme battle of alienation against her father, took her in front of a judge and sat her down at 6 years old all by herself. And the judge said to her, "You have to choose where you're going to go." And she said, one of the little things that hangs with me to this day is that if someone asks me to go to a movie and someone asks me to go to dinner on the same night, I have to go home because I can't choose, and it shuts me down. And she said, if there were anything that I could tell children right now about what to say to a mom or a dad who's making this child choose, it's that you stand up and say, "No, mom, no, dad. I want to have a relationship with my mom or my dad. I have to have that relationship because it makes me whole." She said if kids felt like they could stand up and say that, it would be so incredibly impactful to all of these children who are going through divorce.
I feel for your friend. She was robbed of her childhood.
Absolutely. But fortunately, there are people who can overcome it to a point and still deal with their life. Mike, I talk to people every day who can't, and it's so incredibly sad. And I mean, there's some days when it's 5 o'clock and I've talked to 70 people that day, and there's so much despair and sadness. And this time of year, as I said early on in the broadcast, it's so sad.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart. And what do you do?
Well, the tragedy is, you know, Jill, and I know you're asking rhetorically, what do you do? But the tragedy of it is that it's unnecessary. The thing about it is it is unnecessary. And so what people, you know, what to do is that people have to say, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. And it shouldn't be a child's responsibility to say to adults, don't make me choose. Adults should actually be adult enough to look out for the interests of these children, and yet what we have today is a legal system that provides for those who are so inclined, provides all the tools necessary to use as clubs against the other parent. And in the most tragic of situations, what you see, you know, your friend talking about, I can't make this choice if two people ask me to do something at the same time, and I've got to take a step back. That's a lifetime scar of divorce that was inflicted completely unnecessarily. And that's
Absolutely.
What this process does. And that's why it's so critical to change it. And we have to have, you know, it really is. I heard something say that a fellow say at a U.S. Commission on Civil Rights recently, and what they noted was that the forced removal of parents from the homes of their children is the top civil rights issue of the 21st century. And it was just astounding. It was fantastic to hear it. One of the speakers indicated that, and this was an old civil rights guy, and he said, you know, what if you really want to get the change that's necessary correctly, you have to talk to the people who have been impacted by the system to know how to change the system for the better. And that's where we are today. We've had 50 years now of this system, 40 years, let's say 1970, to 2010 here, 40 years of this particular system. And so we have enough people now who are adults who experience divorce, who experience their parents' divorce as children, that we know what they would have done differently, what they would have liked to have seen. We have the social science research that tells us that we could be doing a whole lot better, and the easiest way to do a whole lot better is to say you can't use this system to beat up another parent, and to say, kids, you're relax. When this is all done, you're still going to have both of your parents in your life. And you know, Jill, I mean, we've been doing this work for a long time. I've never had a kid come to me and say, where was my other parent's check? They always come back and say, where was my parent? And how many parents do we have on the other side that say, I did everything I could to be there? And you deal with those cases every day, just as I do, of folks who have done everything they could to be there and have been frustrated at every step of the way. The system that we have today will take the life out of you if you let it.
And we talked earlier. I have been so disturbed for the last few days about the case in Michigan that's going on right now. And I know some little nuances have come out about the case in the last few hours, but the three little boys, the faces of these little boys that are just incredibly adorable, and these boys are missing at the hand of their father, and mm-hmm. he threatened to commit suicide. I would be curious to know, and I know you don't know a lot about it yet, but I would be curious to know, in their divorce situation, how much of the angst and anxiety that this father had was caused by the court system. Doesn't excuse what the man has done if he has done it, but I'm just curious to know how long they've been in the court system and how much of that was churned up by the system in Michigan.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've read a little bit about that case, and apparently the, you know, what the paper says is a nasty custody battle started in September, but it does say that he took the kids, he went to Florida, tried to get custody of them in Florida. The judge said, no, the case is going to be in Michigan. And this is the insanity of the system, as you know, Jill, that parents would have to, you know, that we call it the race to the courthouse. You get to the courthouse, you file the papers first, and boom, all of a sudden, you know, the other person is now trying to defend who they were. I see that the fellow was an unemployed truck driver. We know what the economy's been like for the last several years. And so now, not only faced with the loss of his job, but obviously there's mental instability there, not to excuse what's taking place. There's mental instability there, and mental instability, unemployment, and the loss of your children and your family. And it is an incredible amount of stress. I mean, you see it in people every day, so do I. And it just doesn't have to be that way. And that's why we're working to change the laws the way we are. There is a better way to do this. It's called shared parenting.
Well, you have your pulse on every state in our nation, really, that is working toward shared parenting laws. What would you say, Mike, is the best state shared parenting law right now?
I don't think any of them are very good, Jill. I'm hearing some positive things. I mean, I'm hearing more positive things out of Florida because they're actually encouraging parents to, you know, to craft parenting plans. It really still is a lot up to the profession. The tools are still there to take out the other parent. I will say this, in Texas, they have what's called extended standard visitation, which basically is a 42% to 58% parenting time split. That is... It's interesting because a lot of it still works on the every other weekend model, but they've managed to finesse it in such a way that you get, you know, you're able to get to about 42% of time as the non-custodial parent or conservator, as they call it in Texas conservatorship. So I would say that Texas, but even in Texas, I mean, we have incredible problems. And let me just say that there are so many financial incentives to not change the system for the people who generate revenue and livelihoods out of keeping this system the way it is. That's the only reason it stays the way it stays, is because there are so many vested interests in leaving it the way it is. But in terms of actually any states that say, you know what, we're not going to pick a better parent here, we're going to give kids both parents in their lives, there are no states that you can say today actually have that particular standard in place. So, you know, Texas is okay, but I'll tell you what, in Texas in January, there's going to be a bill introduced that says parents craft a parenting plan. If parents can't agree, then the court will presume that equal time is best for the kids. That's what should be happening everywhere. That should be a no-brainer. But what we see are special interests that want to block that because they perceive it as a threat to their particular interest or power base or whatever the case may be.
What do you think in Illinois? Now, we've worked for 3 years, and how do you think it will come out in Illinois? What's your best guess?
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to see. And I think that they're going to be, you know, I think that once the legislation is introduced, that's when the long knives will really come out. but I'll tell you what I like about the process. I'll tell you what I like about the process in Illinois and what I don't care for about the process in Illinois. What I like about the process in Illinois is that a number of the vested stakeholders, and for the first time that I can see, non-custodial parents and non-residential parents have really had an opportunity to be at the table. So instead of having everybody else decide what's going to happen for these parents, they've actually had a voice in the process. And in Illinois, the best case scenario I can see right now is that the legislature adopts the recommendations of the committee straight across the board with respect to custody. Because what you have is you have 18 people who have been appointed to this committee who have endorsed the recommendations. And in terms of custody, the recommendation in Illinois will be such that parents will present a parenting plan that they agree to the courts for custody of the children, including time-sharing arrangements. And if the parents are unable to agree, then the law is going to say that each parent should have a minimum of 35% time with the children. That works out to 127 overnights for each parent. What we know is that from a psychosocial development perspective, that's the minimum amount of time that children need with each parent in order to mitigate some of the negative effects of divorce. So best case in Illinois right now, and it's a great improvement, significant improvement over the way the law is in Illinois, is that that will pass unaltered and will be enacted so that parents will actually be left in the primary position of raising their children on a collaborative basis by the crafting of a parenting plan, but that in no case will children have to worry that they will, and by the same token, will parents have to be consumed with the idea that they may have a very, very limited relationship with their children. They're going to know that they're going to end up with at least 127 overnights a year. And what's positive about that is that that recommendation comes with the endorsement of judges, of the family law section of the State Bar Association, of legislators that have served on the committee, of non-custodial parents, of representatives from the state Supreme Court. So we've got all of the stakeholders gelled into this committee, and they have said that's the recommendation that we are going to endorse to the legislature. I think that's very positive.
What kind of opposition do you see to it, Mike? Who would it be that opposes such great changes to Illinois law?
Well, you know, I'm really pleasantly pleased about this, Jill, because the domestic violence organizations, which typically oppose shared parenting laws, their representative was in that committee as well and agreed with these recommendations. And I really applaud her for having done that. She spent many years in advocacy work and also in child support enforcement work, and I appreciate the fact that she said, yes, it's time for us to do things differently. And so as long as we don't have issues of abuse, neglect, and abandonment, then this is what's going, you know, this should be the standard in Illinois. As far as the opposition goes, what you see are some feminist type of interests that don't particularly care for this. The domestic violence sector will have its reservations, but their exceptions have been preserved. You know, if you're abusing the spouse and the kids, you shouldn't be in a position to have custody. By the same token, false allegations of abuse should not be tolerated either as a strategy to remove a parent. And we heard testimony from a number of different attorneys that said it's very hard for us in contested custody cases to get a fair hearing where false allegations of abuse have been raised. So I think one of the things that we're going to have to look at and is really make sure that allegations of abuse are actually substantiated and real versus brought for the purpose of gaining an advantage in a custody case. And that's something that I think that we've looked at, but I do think that the opposition will be the domestic violence groups. There are some vested interests within government bureaucracies, within child support, some child support areas, some social welfare areas that generate revenue on the breakdown of the home. And their money flows around this through federal incentive and reimbursement payments. So you have to have non-intact families to keep these revenue streams going and to keep the federal dollars flowing. So we do see resistance out of some of the bureaucracies, but those objections are fairly easily managed because a lot of that has to do with misperception as to what these laws actually mean in terms of practical effect on the bureaucracies. But they tend to come out, you know, they tend to come out and say, we like things just the way they are. So we can anticipate some resistance there. There'll be some judges that are resistant to implementing this. Mm-hmm. There'll be attorneys that'll be resistant to implementing this because attorneys, frankly, generate very good livings out of the conflict that exists. You know, when you lessen conflict, there is less need for outsider intervention. And it's conflict that justifies the intervention in the private lives of individuals. Whether that conflict is real or created really doesn't matter because it results in the same kinds of interventions. And so if you can remove the conflict, change the culture, you remove the need for this intervention. And those who make their livings by intervening feel threatened by that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
And why would you want to turn your life over, let someone else make decisions about your future and the future of your children, when you could walk in with a parenting plan that's going to be best for everyone, or
right,
let a judge who maybe has never practiced family law make decisions for you?
Well,
why?
I mean, that's it.
Where is common sense? I mean, another rhetorical question, but where is common sense in America today? It's gone.
Well, particularly in the family courts. Where is common sense in the family courts? I mean, that's that's and the interesting thing about this, what America needs to understand, I think it's so important that people don't understand at this point, Jill, is the impact of the family courts on the fabric of American society. People don't get this because it's not covered in the media. You see the sensationalism, and you know, my heart goes out to the family in Michigan. I hope they find those boys alive. I all the way around, that is a tragedy that's developing and playing out. It's a tragedy for the mother who's lost these kids. It's a tragedy for the father who, you know, apparently had some mental illness going on here, not by way of excuse, and most significantly for these three young boys. Here's what we're looking at. People need to understand that the family courts are where the average American's life intersects in a significant way with the government in a most personal level. And today, in a country of 300 million people, over 90 million people have an open file in the family court. And this is an institution that has grown up in America that is very subject to political and special interest manipulation and has not been examined and had the kind of public scrutiny and oversight on it that is necessary. Could you imagine any other sector of our society that 90 million of our citizens interact with that basically gets a pass on public oversight or on scrutiny and review? Yet that's what we have in the family law systems today. And I just don't think people understand how many people in this country have an open file in the family court and are impacted by family court orders.
But, Mike, I have to say, it's not just this country. I just came back from New York from the American Psychiatric and Adolescent Conference, and we talked to people from every country that this is rampant. Divorce, parental alienation, it's all happening all around the world. It's not just the United States and Canada. It's everywhere.
Oh, well, you know, the epidemic and the pandemic of this knows no particular borders and boundaries. But what you look at in countries around the world is that you see very similar types of family law systems to what we have in the United States, that they are predicated on not on maximizing children's relationships with with both of their parents, but they're predicated on the removal of one parent from a child's life, the relegation of a fit parent to visitor status, and the elevation of one parent to a primary status. And what we know from the social science research is that that's the last thing that we should be doing. What we should be doing, if we actually want developmentally healthy children, particularly when they're in non-intact families or in reconfigured families, which are, by the way, over 40% of the families now around the United States are reconfigured families in some way, shape, or form, what we have to recognize and do is to say, let's respond to the social science and the developmental literature that's out there with respect to what's best for children and preserve these biological relationships with both their parents. Jill, could you imagine growing up and not knowing half of who you are?
No, and I think that's the scary thing that most people don't understand when they're going through this, is that when a child loses a parent through divorce and or parental alienation, they're losing half of themselves, and they're losing their heritage. They're losing their medical history. They're losing grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and it breaks my heart. And I interviewed Dr. Saul Goldstein about a month ago on the show, and I said to him, what happens when these children come back? And he said, you have to understand that if these children come back to you after a parental alienation situation, that this is not the child that you knew, that heritage is gone, the character is gone, that you instilled in them, all of the characteristics of you are missing. This is not the person that you bore and raised.
Well, you just hit on something here. And that's it, is that it's bad enough to not know half of who you are in a normal type of a divorce situation that isn't fraught with alienation. But imagine what it does to you as a child to not only not know the other half of you, but be told by the parent that you're with that the other half of you is no good.
Yeah.
And you're to be
yeah.
kept away. And so as you see as a child, personality traits and character traits that emerge in you that are of that parent that you are being told is no good, because you are half of that other parent, then what do you come to think about yourself if you're being constantly told that that parent who you are half of is no good?
It's
devastating.
Right.
It's devastating what we're doing to the children in this society today.
Well, there is a question from the chat room, Mike, that I wanted to ask you, and I just she made a comment that she said that she's an alienated mom, and she said that she was told that the children she had raised were dead. And she was told that by the alienator. And that's very, very sad. And this was a case that happened in Pennsylvania, and her children have been moved around. She's not quite sure where they are, but is asking the question about Pennsylvania. How do you see shared parenting laws there, and are they a progressive state? What do you think is happening there?
In Pennsylvania, what's going on is Pennsylvania actually passed a major revision to their custody codes last year. And to their divorce codes last year. And what they've done is they've actually adopted something that's called the approximation rule. And I am not particularly a great fan of the approximation rule, because the approximation rule basically says this, that the amount of time that you will have with your child after divorce is directly tied to the amount of time that you spent with your child prior to the divorce in caregiving activities. So what we have in Pennsylvania is we have a way that's very convenient to write a parent out by saying, well, when the marriage was going on, that parent really wasn't very active to begin with. But it's a completely different dynamic that happens at that particular juncture, because what's going on after the divorce is not representative of what was going on in the marriage. And this idea of approximation rule without any kind of minimally guaranteed access to the other parent, I think, is going to be very problematic. The idea is, okay, if you were involved with the children before the divorce, you will get to continue to be involved with the children after divorce. But let's look at a home life where the parents have decided, one is going to stay home with the children, whether it be the male or the female. The child's born, one parent's going to stay home until the child gets to school age, and the other parent's going to go out and be in the workforce. Because let's say mom's a lawyer and dad's a school teacher. So they decide that because mom can earn more money, she's going to go out and go back into the law practice, and he's going to stay home and raise the child. At 2 years of age, the marriage breaks down. There's a divorce. He's given 90% of the child care during the time that the child from birth to age two. She went back to the law firm because she could provide a greater income to the family. Now, should she, from age two until that child is 18 years old, should she only be able to see that child 10% of the time because he gave 90% of the child care, and they had agreed that that would be the case until the child was school age, when he was going to go back to work? I'm saying this, that should not be the case. Why should she be cut out of the child's life for the next 16 years based on what they did for the first two? And that's what's happened in Pennsylvania today, is that with the adoption of the approximation rule, without a standard that says there will be at least a minimum of 35% time for both parents, what we've done is been able to open the door where a parent can go in and provide an affidavit that said, I did 90% of the child rearing, and they can get the child from that point forward for 90% of the time because of them having spent that time with the child. And that was purely, in the example I just gave you, that was purely an economic decision. You know, they decided that she would go back to work because she had a greater income than he did. And, Jill, I'm saying that because that's becoming much more common in our society today. And are we going to push mothers away from their children and penalize them for being out because they can bring a greater income into the home than the father? Yet if you look at what the demographics are for education in our society today, more bachelor's, master's, and doctorates are being awarded to women than men. And women's earning capacity in a number of areas is outpacing men's. And so should mom lose the capacity to be a mom because dad stayed home and raised the kid? That's what we were talking about earlier, about there needing to be the recognition of parity between the sexes, both in the home and in the marketplace, and keeping these relationships consistent and constant. So in terms of Pennsylvania, I don't see that the law change. I really just see it's basically going to be more of the same at this point, and I would love to be proven wrong. I would love to see – what I'm seeing in the courts today is that parents are being more sensible about what to do with their kids than the courts have yet caught on to. And what I'm seeing is more parents are choosing shared parenting because they know that's what's best for their kids, rather than the courts ordering more shared parenting. In some pockets, we're seeing the courts order more shared parenting, but there are a lot of these special interests that like things like the approximation rule without any minimum guarantees, because they know it's going to be a continuation of the existing paradigm, and the existing paradigm is broken. It's like, you know, it's like calling, what is it? You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
Right.
I mean, that's what a lot of these law changes are. Yeah. Well, these law changes are in this area. It's basically trying to make a short person sound here.
We have a lot to do, as we've talked about tonight. And unless there are some changes, things are only going to get worse. So we've got to all be advocates for ourselves and for our children, and we've got to get out there and do, you know, we can do what you're doing, not as well, certainly, but you can contact your state representatives, your senators, your congressional representatives, and let them know what you think. They're just people who put their pants on the same way that you and I do, and don't be afraid to approach them. I grew up with one, and I know that they're just normal guys and gals. So please do what Mike's doing. Be an advocate for yourselves and get out there and tell people what you think. It's the only way, unless we create awareness and educate these people on what's going on, nothing is going to change, and our children hang in the balance. And it's just so incredibly important, and I'm so passionate about this, and I know you are too, Mike. I want you to tell people where they can get a hold of you and your website address.
Okay. Our website is acfc.org. It's the American Coalition for Fathers and Children, acfc.org. And then the other thing I just want to say and encourage you, and I don't want to sound negative completely on this particular system, because I also want to say that, like Michelle Lawrence, Judge Lawrence in Chicago, there are some very good people that are working from inside the system to change the system as well, and we need to encourage them. Having said that, we also need to recognize that no one is ever going to care more about your kids than you do. And to entrust them to the system is problematic. So, you know, the other thing is, we just can't afford anymore as a society, Jill. I mean, financially, we can't afford to do things the way we've been doing them. We're going broke. And to have 90 million people in the American Family Courts with a file open in the American Family Courts is bleeding us dry. We need to recognize that. We spend over $100 billion a year in this country on family law nonsense. Taxpayers do. It's just absurd. So I'm right there with you. There's something for everyone to do. And everyone, at least once or twice a year, can reach out and contact the representative, contact their representative, can write a letter to an editor, can say, hey, these are our children. And whether or not we're with our spouse or our former partner, our children still need a full relationship with both of us. That message is getting through. I'm actually positively optimistic that within the next 5 to 7 years, if people get involved and continue to push, we will see shared parenting as the norm across the country.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for that. If anyone out there is having a problem with parental alienation, of course, Parental Alienation Awareness Organization International is available to you at www.paawareness.org, or you can find me on my Facebook page, And my book, of course, is The Look of Love, a novel about adversarial divorce and parental alienation. Love for you to pick it up, read it, and pass it on to someone who doesn't know how incredibly bad the system could be, because it is an educator and it is a book for creating awareness, and that's what it's intended to do. So The Look of Love, available on Amazon and my own website, thelookoflovebook.com. Of course, again, I want to mention Michelle's book, The Good Karma Divorce. Anyone who's going through conflict, adversarial divorce, just deciding to get a divorce, pick this book up, because it gives you a manifesto of how to handle that situation. It's incredible, incredible, incredible. Hang in there, all of you. Tune in next week, Wednesday night. We have Phyllis Schlafly. I'm so excited about that. Of course, an icon in America, and I'm so excited to interview her. And then Joan Meyer on Thursday, the 9th, and she and I are going to be discussing our differences about parental alienation and domestic violence and all of those great issues that are coupled together in so many conversations. So I'm looking forward to that. But Mike, I have to thank you again for coming on tonight and taking time away from your family. Tell your wife thank you for lending you to us for this hour. And I will, of course, talk to you soon, and I'll see you next week. Yes, you'll be in Chicago.
Look forward to it, and I give a hearty endorsement to both your book and Michelle's as well. I've read them both, and they're great, and I encourage people to pick them up.
Thanks so much, Mike. Have a great night. Enjoy your evening.
Thank you, Jill. Take care.
Bye-bye. This is Jill Ajizi. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The book of love is in your eyes. A look your smile can't disguise. The look of love, it's saying so much more than just words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now